Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream on the 29th of December, 2020. 2020 was certainly a year and we're near at the end of it. We've got time to pick the bones over it though, and that's what we're going to do tonight. So it's going to be, I think, an interesting chat. As normal, I just want to start off by just saying that I don't offer financial advice on this channel. This is just a sort of general conversation. Do please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, it's being moderated. This is as at the 29th of December 2020, if you're watching in replay. If you want to get my attention or ask a question, then use @walktheworld to make sure that I see it. There's always lots of stuff going on in the chat. I encourage that, but I don't necessarily read all of the chat streams that are going on. But if you use @walktheworld, there's a really good chance. And also I've enabled Super Chat, which enables you to make sure that your question goes to the top of the list. And also, if you fancy making a donation to help us fund what we do here, cost a bit to get this all going, just helps cover our costs, feel free to make a contribution via Super Chat as well, which is greatly appreciated. Right, with that out the way, and thanks to those saying great music, I'm going to put this up because thank you very much for that comment. Yeah, composed it myself, one of my other little hobbies. When I've got nothing better to do, I do some composition, so that's also what I do. Anyway, without further ado, let me see whether I can bring Michael in. So let me push that button first and push that button. Michael, are you there?
Hi, Martin. I'm here.
Yeah, Eureka. It's all working. How are you doing? Yeah.
Fantastic. Yourself?
Yeah, pretty good. It's amazing, isn't it? End of a year, and what a year it's been.
Oh, it's been a crazy year, probably the wildest financial and health year of my lifetime so far.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I've been around a bit longer than you, and I can tell you that I've never seen anything like it. I lived through three previous crashes, and they were all pretty horrendous, but what we've seen this year is absolutely amazing. So there you go. Now, we should just do a few introductions. I think perhaps a good place to start will be just to say you do have your own YouTube channel, which is called Michael Invests and Tries to Make Money, right? And it's been growing quite fast, actually, over the last little while. So that's very good.
Yeah, I'm shocked there's so many people interested in what I have to say. But, yeah, I'm loving it. I'm just an everyday Australian like everyone else, but just trying to put out my thoughts and opinions there because I've been, you know, following the economy, following the financial markets for a fair few years now. And I do know a thing or two, but, you know, like I said, not a professional, but I'm just sharing my thoughts and I'm really liking the community I'm building and really like talking with the people in your community as well.
Yeah, well, it's great. And I think, you know, this whole idea of having a community and having, you know, orbiting spheres, as it were, of different people sharing ideas and opinions is really, really important insofar that, you know, not getting wired into just one way of thinking or one specific point of view, but actually to have a bit of diversity, I think is really good. So I'm always in favor of encouraging other YouTubers to get going and start their channels. And where I can, I sort of, you know, cross-pollinate and hopefully can help cross-promote. So that's one of the reasons why we're doing this. But also, you had me on your channel a few weeks ago, and I really enjoyed the conversation that we had because your perspective, although it's, you know, the average Australian, I found really interesting. So I thought it'd be worth sharing that more broadly. I've also got a few charts and things up my sleeve so we can talk a little bit about some of those different things. And I guess the place to start probably is just before the virus, pre-virus. Remember the first couple of months, right? We actually had bushfires. We had a lot of interesting negative news in the economy. The unemployment rate was going up, the growth rate was coming down, the household debt levels were going up. So we were actually in a situation where the economy was relatively weak before the virus hit. And then the virus hit, right? And I remember I did my first show, I think February time, talking about the risks of the virus. I did my first interview on ABC News Radio in January talking about what would happen if, and so it transpired. And we're not out of it yet, you know. You presumably were locked down in Melbourne. You're down in Melbourne, right? So you were locked down for a period of time. How was that?
Oh, you know what? It was pretty dreadful. We copped it the worst in Melbourne, but luckily now I've left Melbourne and I'm in regional Victoria, so it's good now. But yeah, it was actually pretty tough being locked down, not being able to go out. And the hardest thing was, you know, not being able to take my son out and go out with him and play with him. So yeah, it was definitely tough.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because, of course, we've now got the issues up in the northern beaches here in Sydney, and we heard today that there is now an unconnected case in Wollongong, which is very close to where we live. So it's getting close. Yeah. So I'm not sure what's going to.
Hopefully, you can keep it down.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, the whole question, of course, is how does it play from this point? I've also got a lot of friends and relations in the UK and in the US. And the UK has now got more people hospitalised than they had at the height of the previous cycle of the virus, which is horrendous. And, of course, the US is also struggling as well. So it certainly is concerning. And I'm not sure that the very optimistic view of the virus getting under control in a few months, thanks to the vaccine, and, you know, everything's going to be back to normal in a few months, is probably a little bit over-optimistic. Certainly the federal budget papers assumes sort of the end of next year before it really is, you know, beginning to open up internationally. So I think there's a bunch of questions about how quickly this is all going to play out, right? And so we're in this sort of miragey environment where, well, it might be good, it might not be good. And that's one of the reasons why I run scenarios, because I think the only way to tackle this is to think about different things that maybe go on. Now, why don't you just give a little bit more background of yourself and you know, talking about investing. What's your investment sort of profile? You know, are you stocks and shares? Are you Bitcoin? You know, what have you been up to?
Yeah, well, me, like I said, I'm just the average Australian. And the reason why I follow these channels and try not to have a biased view, because, you know, I'm a father trying to raise a family, and I'm trying to think, where do I put my money to get the best return, or to not lose my money to inflation, or, you know, with the central banks, with the money printer go burr, they've been saying lately, because, you know, they're just printing money like crazy and people worry that they, you know, they're going to lose value. So me, you know, I'm kind of open to anything. I'm more of what you call a passive investor or an index fund investor. I don't speculate into individual stocks. I don't want to, you know, be reading charts on individual companies' earnings and, you know, reading through all the annual reports every day. I just like investing in index funds, you know, like the ASX 200. No, these are not recommendations. This is what I like, all the S&P 500. You know, just where my money's diversified across hundreds of companies. You know, I can just go off the historical average returns, you know, and that won't always be the case in the future. But that's just a more passive way for me to invest. And I came across that through the FIRE community. I don't know if you heard of the FIRE community, the FIRE movement. That's just pretty much where people try to live really frugal lives and just invest in index funds like the S&P 500, or if we're here in Australia, the ASX 200, just to get an average of 7 to 8%. And also I managed to buy my own house a couple of years ago. So that's a sort of an investment there long-term. We don't know. Or we can get into what we think price is going to be in the short to long-term later. And I have speculated in crypto. Some people probably would know that I made a video about how I got burned and lost a fair bit of money in crypto in 2017. I think some people dropped that in the chat there. But that's because I'm more speculating in the altcoins, because, you know, people would make a alternative coin to Bitcoin and say it's going to change the world and take over Bitcoin. And, you know, I got involved in that in 2017. But I've learned a lot of lessons from there, and definitely what I've learned is you can't predict the market to exactness, and I'm just, yeah, more of a passive investor, and I look for value and look for, I guess, whatever's on discount. You know, I wouldn't want to just be just a stock guy, and then if property dropped 50%, you know, I'd miss out an opportunity to get cheap property, where if, you know, I was just a property guy and stocks fell 50, 60%, if I was just a real estate guy, then I miss out on that, so... I'm up for anything where I can get a good deal.
Okay, now you made a couple of interesting comments, right? Which is, are you investing for growth, or investing for essentially security and, you know, trying to protect your assets? Because those two strategies are very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I invest for growth. I'm young. I'm just trying to build my wealth at the moment. I've got a bit more tolerance for risk right now because I'm young, and I'm trying to build that wealth.
Okay, now it's interesting because one of the things I observe quite often is that, you know, the motivation for investing, and you're right, there is an age profile here, because essentially in the earlier years, people probably want to accumulate more quickly and take higher risks. There's a tipping point where probably later they want to preserve what they've got and make sure it doesn't sort of evaporate, right?
Yeah.
And those strategies, of course, are really quite different as a result of it. And then the other observation you made was about property versus stocks and shares and index funds and all those things. And, you know, it highlights one of the classic conundrums, right, which is how do you structure a set of investments? And we're not giving financial advice, but, you know, chances are it's probably better to have multiple arms to the investment strategy so that you don't have all your risks in one particular basket, because that basket might blow up and then you be in serious difficulty. So it spreads in some of the risks. And the other thing then is to have a sort of core, if you like, which is, you know, your core investments and a little bit of speculation around the edge. And if you want to play at the edges and, you know, risk quite high losses around the edge, that's fine. But what you don't want to do is to risk the total portfolio, because that then leads to potential risks, which are probably way too high. But again, what I find quite often when I chat with people is that they're not very clear often about where in the sort of scheme of things they're investing, you know. So, you know, if they've got a lot of money in Bitcoin, well, is that, you know, an asset for growth, or is that speculative around the edge, because you do things differently depending on how you see it? So there's a bunch of interesting questions that sort of come off the back of trying to figure out how to make investment work.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess the other question is, what's your perspective on inflation, right? So there's a big debate going on. You know, you may have seen some of the things that I've spoken about, inflation, deflation. You know, there are people who claim that the future is highly inflation with all this money printing, all the, you know, all this quantitative easing and everything else. And there are other people, I'm on probably the other side of the fence, saying, no, this is not necessarily particularly inflationary, and in fact, more likely deflationary. But that, again, changes the perspective in terms of what the investment mix might be.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think there's two things. There's the CPI index inflation, and then there's what I call like the cost of living rising. And I think the cost of living, just for me looking at my expenses for the necessities, is definitely going up higher than inflation. But with inflation, with all this money printing and with easy lending, I guess we can look at Europe. You know, Europe, they've had low interest rates or negative interest rates, and they've had low inflation by the consumer price index. And with all this money printing, you know, if people, if they got a scarce mindset, and they, even if they do print a lot of money, but it doesn't go out in the economy, and they talk about the velocity of money, if it doesn't start getting turned over, you won't really get inflation. So it depends really on the confidence of people. If people are going to go out there and they're going to start spending, we could see inflation. And it's also about the lending, how much the banks are going to lend. So that's what I'm watching.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, what's fascinating, and I might put this this slide up here, this is actually from the latest credit aggregate numbers, right, which showed that broad money is now growing on an annualized basis at 12.4%, but total credit growth is just 1.7%, right? So there's something weird going on with all this liquidity that's being created. It's not going into the real economy at the moment. It's not actually getting significant credit momentum. What it is doing, it's going into financial markets, and it's going into various other sectors of the economy, it blowing up some types of assets, but it's not translating into the real world. Now, you know, the question is, well, if that is the case, then are we actually more in for a deflationary environment? And you know, I chat with Steve Van Meter in the US quite often about this very issue, because Steve is of the view that, in fact, as interest rates come down and as money printing continues, it's actually a deflationary, not an inflationary strategy, right? And despite what the Reserve Bank and other banks around the world think. Now, if that's true, then, you know, however you measure inflation, I agree that there's some stupidity in the way that inflation is measured, but ultimately the economy might actually not pull itself out. And of course, you can look at Japan and you can look at Europe as examples of economies where they've gone negative rates and they've done a lot of quantitative easing and the economy is still not functioning very well. So this is a really critical question. And I just wonder sometimes whether, in fact, the expectation of inflation is overdone. And if it is overdone, that means that people holding gold and people holding, you know, the precious metals against protection for future inflation might actually find that it doesn't necessarily work as they expect.
That's exactly right. And Also, something I'm a bit speculative, or you might think a bit of a conspiracy or something. I wonder too, how much they may try to downplay inflation or try to skew the numbers to the lower end, because if inflation did go get higher, could they actually afford to raise interest rates? And that's something I think that's a big risk to the economy. If inflation did start to creep up there, and then they did get pressure, okay, we've got to get this inflation under control. If they had lift interest rates, within the next couple of years, would look like what the Fed tried to do in, I think, it was 2018 or
That's
2019.
right.
The stock market just started dropping straight away.
Well,
So.
yeah, I mean, Powell tried to sort of do that, right? And then basically he had a battle with the markets, and the markets won, and he had to turn tail and run. And then we've got another three point something trillion of liquidity thrown in by the Fed. The Fed's still doing it, of course, and we'll probably do more of it, even at a slower rate. So yeah, basically the market won, and they just wanted more of it. And that's one of the reasons why stock markets around the world are actually so high at the moment, right? So it's quite fascinating if you start looking at individual charts. Now, I know what you said about charts, but I've got a few charts. So just trust me on this, right? It's okay. We can definitely talk about some stuff. I'm just want to show you this one, right? I thought I'd start with this. This is actually the ASX 200. Okay, it's over the last year, right? So basically, I've gone from the start of the year to the end of the year, and it's down overall 3.3%, right? Now, that's quite interesting insofar that we had obviously the big dip, right? Around March, and then we've been climbing our way back, and it's just slightly below. If you look at the ASX 100, it's pretty much the same, right? Now, what's interesting is if you compare that with the US, right? The Dow is up 5.8%, right? So, in other words, the Australian markets have performed less well relative to the US markets. Now, one of the interesting questions then to ask is, well, why is that? And the short answer is that it's really to do with the mix of different types of stocks. So if you, for example, look at something like Google in the US, right, it's up 24%, right? They've got a big tech-heavy sector there. Apple, is up a lot as well. I'm trying to get that up. Come on, there are 76%. Apple's up 76% over the year. I mean, those are amazing moves, right? Now, that's one of the reasons why the US has done a lot better. Plus, of course, the fact that they've got even more liquidity than ourselves. So there's some interesting things going on there about, the market moves and how they've been tracking, right? And I do look at some of those charts because I think it's quite interesting and important to understand what that dynamic is and why is it growing. Now, if you come back to Australia, and then if you look at, for example, let's go here, let's go there, look at CBA, right? CBA is an interesting example. If you look at CBA, there we go. So CBA is at 1.83% over the year, right? So big dip and then a rise up. Whereas Westpac, right, is down 20% over the year. So even within individual stocks, the performance has been very diverse, right? And so the point that I was trying to get to was you spoke about tracking the index, right? The trouble with the index is it will mask the good and the bad ones, right? And so what you end up doing is averaging the index, not necessarily maximizing the performance if you know which ones to look for. So that's an interesting conundrum, which of course everybody's wrestling with when it comes to, so how do I actually, work out how to get performance? And the other thing about indices is, by definition, an index won't outperform the index, right?
That's right.
And if everybody is tracking the index, then you get everybody's index performance. Now, luckily, this year the index has not done reasonably well. But that makes some interesting observations in terms of how markets actually work.
Yeah, that's right. And so, yeah, like you were saying, with indexes and, like I said, with the S&P 500 at all-time highs, that is because, like you said, the top five holdings and the way the indexes are weighted, 25% of the indexes, in Facebook, Amazon, the FANG stocks. So they made up such a big part of that index. That's the reason why it's at all-time highs. You may be thinking, why is, you know, the stock market all-time highs when the economy is going so bad? And that's because these tech companies have actually benefited from the pandemic, and they've, you know, been doing better than ever. Where there may be, you know, if there's an S&P 500, there may be 490 companies that are in the red. And yeah, like I said, if you can pick the winners, yeah, you'll definitely outperform the index. But there's a lot of research to show, you know, that 90 to 95% of hedge fund managers over a 30-year time frame can't outperform the market. Yep. And like I said, I don't think I'm better than any of these hedge fund managers, and I don't particularly want to try to outperform. Like, I just want that passive return. So that's just my investing style.
Makes perfect sense, and of course the fees are a lot lower because it's passive rather than active, and that fees are one of the really critical things to understand, because fees erode returns dramatically, and it's cumulative. So, you know, low fees are really important. One of the interesting comments was the ASX is bank heavy. Absolutely, it still is, even now. We are very heavy, of course, on banks and resources. Our tech sector is minute relative to say the US, and that's because we don't really invest in investment in that sector. Entrepreneurs find it very difficult to actually get going here. I made a show a little while ago with somebody from the tech sector, and he basically said, look, it's close call as to whether we stay here or whether we go overseas, because it's so hard to get investment. So we have a fundamental structural issue insofar that our economy is much more weighted towards the old, if you like, eternals, right, of resources and finances, finance sector, rather than the new tech stuff. The also worth making the point, I think, that the techs, of course, did really well with the lockdown, you know, from Zoom. If anybody bought Zoom, they would have done pretty well, through to a lot of the other techs as well. So, you know, they've actually benefited, and they've probably given us a bit of an acceleration of a new world where it's digitally enabled. I mean, look at what we're doing now. Yeah, you know, you and I are chatting in two cities, right? We're sharing our thoughts with a whole bunch of people on the stream, and we're, you know, it's all just working. I mean, it's fingers crossed. Of course, now I've said that.
It's working. Yeah. I've got wood here. I'll cut some wood.
It's probably worth doing that. Yeah. But no, but it makes the point, right, that, you know, the lockdown itself created some new opportunities, right, and it created new momentum, particularly at the tech end. I think that Australia is missing the boat here when it comes to some of that new innovation. We don't have the right R&D structures. We don't have the right entrepreneurial structures. And frankly, we don't have a government who's really interested in stimulating the new stuff. They prefer to stimulate construction and all those things. We'll get on to construction shortly, because that's something you and I should chat about in more detail. But it is interesting. I wanted to put this one up. Where can I find it? Let's go there.
While you're doing that, like you're saying, the ASX is made up of very heavy in banks, and the reason why, and again, why the Australian market has performed bad to the US market, because the banks have been affected pretty bad by this, with having, you know, for a little while they had their dividends cut, and then also all these loans that are put on hold, you know, their revenues have dropped a fair bit.
Well, that putting the stuff on hold is actually very interesting, right? Because that's not going to come off until March, right? And then if they start foreclosing, it's going to be another 6 months before it really comes through. So we won't know what the true default rates are. And interestingly, the Reserve Bank came out just before Christmas in a speech saying they're worried a little bit about some of the default rates in the loan portfolios, which haven't yet appeared, right? So that's, I think, part of the story in terms of trying to work out what is going on. All right. Okay. Here we go. I'm going to show you. This is the Aussie Bitcoin cross at the moment, just to give maximum effect. There you go. Yeah, so from the start of the year, so this is just this year, up 201%.
Yeah, not bad.
And that obviously is including the exchange rate. Now, if you go to the US one, right? So, oops, what's happened here? Come on, click there. Let's go that way. I need to go up here. The internet's a bit hiccupy at the moment. I hope it's not going to fall over. What I wanted to do was to look at the Bitcoin US. Okay, so it's 232% in US dollar terms, right? And that's because, of course, the exchange rate's moved against us.
Yes.
Right? And that's one of the other factors that people sort of should bear in mind, right? Because there's been quite an interesting set of moves. Aussie dollar, US dollar is up 10% from the start of the year. So the 10% move, right? So that's cancelled some of the growth from the Bitcoin when it's in US dollars, right?
Yeah.
But that 10% move is very significant. So we're up at around 76 cents. Now, the point about 76 cents is that the Reserve Bank wouldn't want the rate to be that high. The Reserve Bank would want it to be a lot lower because, of course, what's happening there is we're effectively importing in deflation rather than inflation, right? So they want the exchange rate a lot lower because it then makes our goods more cheaper from an export perspective, and we import inflation, which is what they want. It's going the wrong way. So that's something else that the Reserve Bank is going to scratch their heads about, I think, for some little time. But it's interesting how all of these things interact, right? So if you're actually, investing and exposed in US dollars, you've got the exchange rate risk as well as the local market risk. So it's pretty complicated. Now, your story with regard to Bitcoin, of course, it's a question of when you buy, when you sell, isn't it? Right? And, there's a big debate about, is Bitcoin highly speculative? Well, to an extent, yes. But there are now more people piling in, particularly institutional investors, right? And we know that a number of financial services companies are now investing big in Bitcoin. PayPal, of course, is now taking payments in Bitcoin on their platform, although there's some funnies about how they do it, which means it's rather complex. But, when I talk to people about the future of Bitcoin, it's still bifurcation between those who think that it's highly speculative, based on nothing, and will turn to water at some point, or those who think it's going to be the future of money and will actually be the digital gold, right? I don't know where it is in that spectrum, right? So therefore, you pay your money, it takes your choice. What I would say is that the momentum that we've seen in recent times has been pretty amazing, right? And most of the people that I read are suggesting that it's different this time. Now, let's check in 6 months' time as to whether it really is different. What's your perspective on what's happened to Bitcoin this year?
Yeah, well, I guess I got the perspective of I was part of Bitcoin 2017 when it was pretty much the exact same thing as what's happening now. There was a huge boom. I think I noticed Bitcoin when it hit about $1,700 Australian, took over the price of gold in Australian dollars. It's like, oh, what's this Bitcoin? Oh, must this be some scam or something? This was in 2017. And I just kept watching it rise, and I think it got to around 5,000 Australian, and then I was like, all right, I'm going in. I started FOMOing in and told my friends about it. And, I would have been all right if I just did that, just stayed with Bitcoin. But then, there was things like Ripple, Ethereum that started going up 10x and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, if, 100% return, that's nothing. I'll get into these altcoins. And so, yeah, long story short, lost a little bit of money there, not too much. But same thing did start to happen with the speculation of the institutional money. There is a bit of institutional money coming into Bitcoin now, which, does make a big difference. And I think you can see that because of the way the prices go up so rapidly in one day. That's probably a big buy buying up. But there was the same speculation, I think, in 2017 when they were talking about all the Bitcoin futures coming on, and with Goldman Sachs started getting in. And then once it crashed, that kind of just, just went away, and then kind of just died for a few years. Still hear me, Martin?
Yeah, you disappeared, but you come back.
Yep. Keep going. Sorry to knock the cord there. So I think it could probably maybe see the same thing. There could be some euphoria now, could keep going up. Who knows if it's going to hit 50K. But I think there is this FOMO happening now, a bit of euphoria. But I do have a small little speculative position because, again, it is speculative. It's a new asset class. It's not tangible. It's not something you can see. You don't know who the creator is. It doesn't pay you a dividend or pay you any income or any interest. I think some people are saying maybe it's kind of like digital gold where, it's a hedge against inflation or a hedge against all this money printing, or, like you said, could become, the new global currency. I doubt that will probably happen. But, yeah, I do think it's a speculative investment. I think maybe it might have some momentum for the next 6 months, but then it'll probably be a big correction coming soon, because that's normally what happens with Bitcoin and with crypto. There's a big rises and big crashes, and you know, all the hardcore crypto investors would say they call it hold on for dear life, just because it's such a wild ride. So yeah, definitely as an investor, I wouldn't put any, not again, it's not financial advice, but I wouldn't put any more of 5% of your portfolio in it. If you do want to invest in it, is a very speculative investment, and it's probably not a good time to be getting in now.
Well, it's interesting. People are still buying, even now. Quite a lot of that money is coming from institutions. Also, of course, a lot of it's coming from new investors, right? So people who got their $600 check from the Fed or you know, from the US government, right? And got a bit of money and they've gone in and doing quite well at the moment. The question is, will it continue? Now, you know, I would still put Bitcoin in the speculative. You know, if you think of a series of concentric rings, right, in my sort of investment strategy, there's stuff in the middle, which is my core. And that's about asset protection, and that's about security and certainty. And there's a little corona around the edge. And that's where I'd put the Bitcoin bit. So I agree with you, a few percent, you know, if you want to play and put it there, because you can basically say, well, if it disappears and I lose everything, it's not going to be the end of the world, right? But I do know some people who've actually gone so big into Bitcoin that basically it's now become their biggest asset. Then the question is, well, how long do you hold it for? You know, yeah, at what point do you say, I need to get out just in case, right? That's the challenge, particularly when it's continuing to rise. I was chatting to somebody offline yesterday about it, who's got a big position and is now in a dilemma, right? Because it's going up, going up, going up. Doesn't want to sell too early. And I just said, well, just remember this, you can never pick the top or the bottom of the market. By definition, you can't do it. Nobody can, right? All you can do is to say, is there a, you know, a potential positive gain if I do something as if I don't do it? My own view is that if people have made significant gains in recent times, it might be worth thinking about crystallizing some of those gains and then enjoying them later, rather than just assuming that it's going to continue on its trajectory for the next 6 to 12 months. Although, you know, there are people, Peter Schiff and a few others, who are saying gold and Bitcoin is the future, and that's where it should be. And I do believe that there is going to be a future for a digital currency. Although I'm personally of the view that central bank digital currencies will become more and more critical. And as it gains scale, of course, the scale is still quite small at the moment. As it gains scale, what we will find is that the central bank controlled digital currencies will become ever more critical in the scheme of things. And that's when it's really going to get very interesting.
Yeah, I think we did talk about that towards the end of our show on my channel, about the central bank digital currencies. And there's a lot of talk now about a Fed coin or a digital dollar. And, you know, with China, they've tested some digital currencies. And then, yeah, it could get pretty crazy after that, because I'm always looking at the next 5-10 years thinking, what are they going to do now? You know, the whole world's pretty much at 0% interest rates. They've printed all this money. What else can they do if another crisis comes? And that's why I think maybe they will go down the next route, some kind of digital currency where they can send it to people's wallets and say, look, you got to spend this within X period of time before it expires. You know, I do see maybe one day, who knows when, if it's 5-10 years, whatever, but I think that will be coming one day, digital currency from central banks, because even with negative interest rates we've seen in Europe, it hasn't really worked.
No, it hasn't. Absolutely not. No. In fact, Europe has probably the biggest issue at the moment, if you look at what's going on there, with negative interest rates, negative deposit rates for some people, particularly in Germany, over a certain amount. So, you know, those negative interest rates start at the wholesale level, but ultimately cascade down. And it's interesting that the guys in Europe did some quite big pieces of work on the complications and implications of these low interest rates, and you know, and the speculative nature of what's going on. Banks have to take more risks to try and get returns. One of the reasons why they might be investing in things like Bitcoins and other things as well. And they actually are a little bit less likely to lend. So this is, you know, cul-de-sac time. I have not yet seen an exit strategy for these very low rates and the negative interest rates that are around. And therefore, we are following a little bit blithely into this one-way street, right, without an exit. And I just I'm concerned that we get into this sort of cul-de-sac where rates go lower, 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 returns get lower, 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 and the economy gets more and more stagnated with no way out. And that has a huge impact on all asset classes. And ultimately, then the question is, well, is that going to happen to stock markets too, right? So I guess, you know, if we move on from Bitcoin, I've shown you the growth in asset prices, you know, on the exchanges. But if you do the calculation based on price to earnings ratios, in other words, in theory, what a stock should be worth, right, then they're about 30 to 40% overvalued, pretty much across the board. Mm-hmm. And that's because of all the money printing. So yeah. The question is, how long can that go on for? And what if it doesn't go on? And, you know, that's why people like Harry Dent talk about a crash is coming. We don't know when, but a crash is coming. And all this liquidity printing is going to create a crash on one side. And you've got other people, including those in the mainstream investment houses, saying, no, the stocks are not overvalued at all. Everything's fine. Plenty of upside. So, again, you can choose which side of that argument you want to play. What do you think? I mean, are stocks overvalued or do you think it's fair value?
Yeah, they're definitely overvalued, but the thing is we're comparing them to historical values where interest rates were much higher. Now, that's what I'm thinking. The reason interest rates have made these crazy high values, and to know whether they're going to go down or not, it's hard because we're in a whole different world now with 0% interest rates and with quantitative easing and with bond buying programs. And then even the Fed started buying corporate bonds. And so I think investors are kind of feeling kind of invincible right now because they think, oh, look, if you know there's a crash, the central banks will come in, they'll buy all the junk, or they'll come in and bail me out. So it is really hard to value stocks right now with this new environment we're in, with the 0% interest rates, with the quantitative easing. But yeah, there is probably going to be a crash, you know, sometime. There's always crashes. But like I said, I invest for the long term. If a crash does come, I'll be dollar cost averaging into that because, like I said, no one can pick it. And even if there's a crash and you just invest for 30 years, you'll be miles ahead of the average Joe Blow that just spends everything they have, puts the rest on after paying credit cards. So that's my take on that. But yeah, I do think stocks are overvalued.
Mm. And I think you made a very important point, right? A lot of the people that I speak with who say, yeah, the markets are overvalued, right? And so some of the smart money is sitting on the sidelines at the moment saying it will definitely come back and that'll be the buying opportunity of a lifetime, right? And people refer back to the, you know, the early 1900s, sorry, the early 20th century, I should say, when you know, 1920s, 30s, right? People made fortunes during the crash by zigging whenever it was zagging. Right.
Yeah.
Now that contrarian view might be the minority view, but nevertheless, history has shown that in some circumstances that's the right view to take. But you have to hold your nerve and be prepared to go against the stream for quite some time, and watch the markets go higher and higher and higher, and still believe that, well, ultimately, you know, there isn't a new science, there isn't a new world order, there isn't a new low interest rate world where suddenly assets are now worth a lot more than they were. You know, the fundamentals are still the fundamentals and they will come back to the fundamentals. Now, that's what many people hold to. Other people will say, no, we're in a whole new world. All of this liquidity that the central banks are creating basically have created this complete about face in terms of the value of things, and therefore we can't use the old valuation tools to be able to make an assessment of what the true value is of stocks or shares or anything. So again, it just highlights the dilemma and the complexity that we're in, and it's not surprising that you see such diverse views on all this on many channels and you know, in the real world too.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, let's go on to talk about property a bit. I wanted just to pick up this one from Cookie Boy, right? So Cookie Boy poses this question. Be interested to hear Michael's and my thoughts on retail and commercial property. He was in Wollongong earlier today. It's not a pretty sight. Wollongong is not a hugely pretty sight at the best of times. But the point is, if you go down the strip in Wollongong, there are way more empty shops than previously. And it was always pretty bad. There seems to be a huge crisis in terms of shops just folding, and now some of the commercial space within some of the larger, structured environments are also looking pretty sick as well. Now, this is quite important, right? Because it's been a significant proportion of the economy, and there are a lot of superannuation funds and a lot of other investors who've been investing heavily in commercial and looking for significant returns from commercial for some time. So if this is true, and if what's happening in Wollongong is reflective of other places, and people have sent me various videos from other locations across the country, it looks to me as though this is probably going to be the leading indicator of significant pressures ahead. And it's worth just reflecting on this, that the bankruptcy laws, which of course were, you know, put on hold, come back into force at the end of this year, right? So now people have to actually be a bit more careful about continuing to trade in a situation where they perhaps shouldn't be trading. So my own perspective would be that we're going to see more retail and commercial failures in the next few months ahead, seeing in my surveys too. And that's going to have a continued negative feedback loop on the commercial sector. Now, the Reserve Bank said only 6% of bank lending is for commercial purposes, and that's way down from what was previously. So the banks have sort of pulled their horns in. But nevertheless, I think it's quite a big deal, whether you're seeing retail closures down there in Melbourne. What's going on down there?
No, definitely. I have seen a lot of empty shops in Melbourne. When you go through the CBD, you just see them everywhere. And that's something I'm pretty worried about, that could affect the property market, whether these turn into residential and then add supply to the residential market. Or even with people that lost their jobs, a lot of people saying, oh, look, the people that were on lower incomes that lost their jobs that probably weren't going to be able to afford property $700,000 to $800,000 anyways. But what I'm worried about is a lot of the small businesses, because a lot of them would own property and investment properties. So if you're a cafe owner right now, if you're a bar owner, restaurant owner, there's just a lot of uncertainty, because they just seem to be the one that keep getting picked on. As soon as, you know, there's a little outbreak anywhere, they shut them all down straight away. So I do think that is definitely a big risk. And also the trading while insolvent thing definitely did cover that up for a little while. And also what I'm interested to see is the bad actors that were trading while insolvent, how is that going to affect then the good companies that, you know, weren't insolvent, but then they may have racked up bills with the good companies, and then that affects them and came, so kind of like a domino effect.
Yeah, that network effect is really, I think, one of the most critical things. I'm not sure people understand it, right? Because as you say, you might yourself not be in difficulty, but if you've got bills owed by organizations who are in difficulty, you might have a problem you don't know you've got until it's too late, right? So the network effect of this running on. And I spoke to a couple of insolvency practitioners quite recently who said, just wait 6 months or so. This will all come home to roost, and there'll be a lot of difficulty because there are lots of firms who probably should not have actually been continuing to trade, but are continuing to trade. And now it's going to start. Now, I know the government's made some changes, tweaks to the rules to, you know, change the structures to protect businesses a little bit more like the US structure. But nevertheless, my own feeling is it's probably going to be a significant factor over the next few months. And in fact, my surveys, and I survey households and I survey small businesses, the small business data is much more negative, both in terms of sentiment, borrowing, compared with the consumers. And that's because I believe that the commercial sector and the retail sector is where a lot of the pain is going to be. And of course, the lockdowns in the Northern Beaches, not helping.
Yeah, exactly. If you've been struggling for 6 to 9 months and then you kind of get to the end of the year, you think it might just be picking up, and then to be shut down again, that must be pretty devastating.
Yeah, and there's another perspective which we can look at, and this is the credit aggregates for November by category, right? So the owner-occupied lending rose annualized 5.4%. Investor was minus 0.1% over 12 months, so housing overall was 3.4%. Business was only 0.9% over the last year. And that's with that massive spike in March, April, May, when many businesses exercised their options to pull down their credit lines. If you took that out, then it'd be negative. And personal credit was down 12% odd, right, over the last year. Turning around now, but still very low. So we're not seeing much evidence, as far as I can see, of businesses willing and able to invest. Right? Now, remember, of course, that the government has given significant tax breaks for people to buy new kit and write instant asset write-off on those sorts of things. But if businesses are worrying about their state, they're not going to invest. You know, it doesn't make any sense to do it. So you wonder to what extent the government strategies of essentially finding, you know, tax routes and trying to get the businesses to do the heavy lifting is actually going to work. Certainly my survey suggests that many businesses are hunkering down. They're not investing at the moment. They've got no intention to invest. And if that's true, then don't expect to see business credit growing anytime soon. And if that's true, then the overall economy, I think, is going to remain in weak territory for a long time. And it goes back to what I said, very little focus on entrepreneurial support, very little focus on true businesses. Now, that's not true for the property sector, and we'll come on to that in a second, right? Because, you know, there, if you're in the construction sector, the government's handed money left, right and centre to keep that sector going. But what about the rest? What about the small business sector? What about, you know, mum and dad businesses who are the real core of Australia? I mean, to my mind, that's something which has really been left just hanging, and I'm very disappointed by that, but not surprised.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something I've seen, not just in Australia, but around the world. Small businesses have gotten destroyed, and it's just making them mega corporations bigger because they've got, you know, capital. They can they can issue bonds and then have the central banks buy their bonds. Where, you know, if your mum and dad pop shop, you can't create a bond, and then even if it's a junk bond, and then have the Federal Reserve buy it or a central bank buy it. So they're definitely doing it tough, and that's something I'm definitely worried about. And I think if a lot of them do own property, then a lot of them do start defaulting, and then that stock does come in the market, then, you know, that could affect property prices, or could affect confidence mid to late next year.
Yeah, and as Damien said there, without business investment, we don't have assets able to produce income to pay down debt and interest, and that's exactly the point. Business is the economic engine of growth, and the point there is if you actually end up spending all of the money to support the construction sector and keep house prices up to try and protect the banks, which is what they're doing, what actually means is we're not supporting the businesses who actually create the growth, to create the multiplier effect, to create the momentum in the economy that we need for the economy to work. Yeah. And that's the problem. Remember, you know, so there are 1 million or thereabout 1 million people working in the construction sector, right? And a lot of those people are now very busy because we've got home builder, we've got all the grants and everything else. But as I keep saying, all you're doing is lifting the price simply across the board. And you look at homeland packages in Perth, for example, up by precisely the amount of the incentive scheme. And I did a show a couple of days ago, specifically highlighting the fact that foreign investors were being teased by getting access to that money as well. So we are throwing money at the construction sector, right?
Yeah, I was actually shocked when I saw that. I think I actually did a video, and I was kind of like joking, like, what more could the this was when prices were still dropping. It's like, what could the Australian government do to stimulate the property market or to stop it from crashing? Like, or they could pay overseas investors to buy property, and then maybe they saw it, like, that's a great idea, let's do that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, I've said a few times that this is really about supporting the banks by keeping house prices up, because if house prices were to fall, they'd have huge debt issues, liquidity issues, etc., right? So they're trying to keep this sort of this balloon going, but in the process they're starving other parts of the economy of the cash that should be being thrown. And you know, my problem is this: I reckon we'll end up with a total debt bill of about 1.8 trillion in a few years' time, right? You know, if you add it all up. And 1.8 trillion is a big number. And the MMT guys will say, that's fine because interest rates are really low and, you know, governments are not like household budgets. It's not a problem, right? And I sort of buy that. But the other side of it is you have to ensure that the investment that you're making is going to create a multiplier effect, is going to create sufficient momentum in the economy to be able to make it worthwhile. That's what happened when they built the hydro scheme, you know, earlier on in the last century. It created a huge amount of additional momentum in the economy. The question is, how much of this money that's being used at the moment is actually going to create the right outcome? Or is it merely just trying to support the previous mode of operation of the economy? And if that's the case, then you don't necessarily end up with anything that's going to create value, which means you end up with a lot of debt but no economic growth. That's what I fear.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. I think if most investors could borrow at 0.1%, that would take as much as they could get, because there's lots of places you can get a much greater return. But yeah, when you're dealing with governments, they're not always very productive with where they put their money. They might be, too busy going their private jets or their, $10,000 dinners. you got to be productive where you put it. If they could put it in productive places, we might be all right, but I don't have too much confidence in them. What was I going to say? So you got 0.1% interest put in the productive place. Sorry, you go. I've lost my train of thought.
No, that's fine. That's fine. But politicians. What's interesting is there's also state budgets, right? State debt. And I reckon there's about $250 billion of state debt being racked up too, right? So as well as the federal stuff, you got the state stuff, right? So basically there's debt wall ceiling, right? Now, I subscribe to an extent to the MMT theory that, a state budget is not the same as a household budget. I understand that. But it comes back to only if it's invested in the things that creates momentum for the future. And I see no focus on strategies for, energy efficiency, greening, climate change, all the big issues, the big sector issues, which have to be addressed. We've got no choice. It's got to be addressed. And yet that's not where we're spending. We're choosing to spend the money, the whole amount of money that's there on things that ultimately may not get us to where we need to get to. And that I find very unsatisfactory. But, frankly, that seems to be the track that the government's on and has been on for some time. So I don't see it necessarily going to change.
Yeah, and it seems like all governments have, completely given up on paying back the debt. I think they've all given up. Now they're all saying, yeah, we've got to grow the economy, faster than the interest. And like I said, if they do put it in good investments and in good things for our future, I think it will turn out good. But I don't have too much confidence that they will.
No. Now let's turn on then to the other really important question, and that's China, right? So, we know that we have 30 to 40% of our momentum coming from China, directly or indirectly, right? We export, we were exporting a lot of stuff there. We now know that lobsters, some timber, some coal, some other goods and services are also off the agenda. They are still taking our iron ore. The price of iron ore is still very high, and that's actually created a sort of a much higher return than people expect, although the forward budget suggests it's going to drop later on. But we do seem to be very trade exposed to China. I'm not sure that we have a strong strategy in terms of what the alternative may be. Have you had a chance to sort of think about that and what the implications may be in terms of how that could flow through to the economy?
Yeah, I do think they'll have a big effect on the economy because, like we all saw in 2008, one of the main things that stopped us from going into a recession was China buying up all our resources. And that's just another thing that's come up that's going to affect the economy. Like we saw, we had all the bushfires that were happening early in the year, and then we've had COVID, and we thought we got through that. But now we're having this other risk here with China, and I guess we'll have to see. There are all people now saying, it's not going to be all good with Joe Biden. Now president, we're all going to be good buddies. But if that does continue to escalate, that may stop us in our tracks with us returning to good economic growth, because China is such a huge trading partner with Australia.
Yeah, well, it is interesting. And I find it fascinating to see, again, the government's been talking still more about the inquiry into the origins of the virus, right? They've this week amped it up again and said, no, we need to get to the bottom of it, right? Which doesn't look to me as though that's the way to sort of smooth the situation with China. But maybe they're sort of making the point that they're not going to stop, right? Even if China is going to become more and more aggressive. And it's interesting, again, I did a post the other day, Stan Grant, who's at the ABC or associated with the ABC, made a very interesting point about the assumption that, the sort of the Western values was the global values, right? And everybody should migrate to those global values, when in fact only about 20% of the world's economy is actually those Western values. And there are many other values, and some of those in China, which are completely different. So there's a whole bunch of new questions about what the right world order is for the future, and it's not necessarily just the propagation of the standard Western philosophy to how to do things. And I thought that was quite interesting, because what that basically says is, well, you know, maybe there's not a question of you know, China having to come across, or we have to go across. They've got to find an alternative path and accept the multiplicity of different value sets on a global basis. Now, that's going to be an interesting challenge in itself.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think eventually countries like China and India will overtake the West, just because this is the way I look at it. With common sense, we plan for the next 4 years, or we do what will benefit us in the next year, 2 years, 3 years. Where countries like China and India, they're planning for, you know, for the next 20, 50, 100 years.
The long game.
Yeah, the long game. And it's working out for them pretty good now. And I do think they'll just continue to grow. And also, you know, in Australia, you know, we've got a so-called democracy. Everyone, you know, has an opinion, and they want, you know, their agenda to be played, where they're kind of... I guess it's to their advantage, you know, they're more communist countries, and so that they can just go, nah, this is what we're doing, this is what's best, and then they just go and do it. Not I'm saying that's right, but that's kind of what's benefited them so far by having that political structure.
Yeah, well, absolutely right. And in a way that they've got more authoritarian modes of operation, which means they can get stuff done. That's interesting that Paul put up this post, which I thought was quite interesting. Thorium, nuclear power, hydro, this is where China will be by 2030. And of course, China has actually got a net zero by 2060, I think, and they've got significant plans before that to essentially migrate their economy. Now, some people will say, well, that's just propaganda. But no, I think there's actually evidence that they are starting to do some quite interesting things. I was listening the other day to somebody talking about the number of electric cars that were being rolled off the production lines in China. It's something like 10,000 a week. Wow. I mean, that's a lot of cars.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, there is real stuff going on there. And then if you look at the situation here in Australia and how seriously we're taking the whole question of the environment and climate change and, you know, whatever we're doing, it feels as though we're rather a long way behind the some of the leading contenders for a green future. And I know that our environmental footprint is rather different, because, you know, it's small in absolute terms, but on a per capita basis, we're right up there. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that we're missing something important in all of this. So, you know, but what's fascinating about, as you start getting some of these things, you see how complicated this is, because you've got international relationships, you've got financial relationships, you've got technology relationships, you've got government power, you know, all of these things are connected and it's all tied together. And what I think is quite interesting is that so often we seem to just go, maybe it's a political level too, down a single issue, but not actually sort of think about the consequences. You sort of start pulling on the rope and it starts to unwind and it starts to then touch a lot of other things. I just don't see much joined up thinking. And that's the thing I get really frustrated about personally. I'm a philosopher, right? So I always want to sort of think about the big picture and think how we fit together. But to my mind, you can't solve just a little bit of the problem. You need to actually sort of try and stand back and think about how the overall connection, the overall web works. I think if you did that, you'd have a different perspective. But that's not what I'm seeing. No joined up thinking here is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's what I try to do. I try to take opinions from everywhere, from you know, to the left, to the right, you know, to the bulls, to the bears. Because, yeah, if you just watch or listen to one source of media or one opinion, you know, you eventually just program your brain to think that way. So I do think it's very important to look at the whole picture, take opinions from each team, each side of the fence. And then you have to do something that's pretty hard and not many people do these days. And then you have to think for yourself and think, okay, how does this, you know, affect me? Because also everyone's personal situation is different, or their stage in life is different.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I never claim to be a definitive and say my truth is the only truth, right? And in fact, on my channel, I do try to have a diversity of voices. And in fact, I am trying very hard to get probably bulls to come on and sort of debate with me. What I must tell you is that they get very, very twitchy and decide not to, right, when I start getting enthusiastic about having them on. So open invitation if you know any property bulls who will be interested in coming on to the DFA channel and debating with me about what's going on and, you know, property, et cetera, et cetera. It's a genuine open invitation. So, folks, do your best to see if we can get some of them on. Because I think it's important. You know, I would like to have intelligent debate, intelligent and debate, right, rather than just doing, you know, a doctrinal position. Intelligent debate about this stuff, because there are some things that some of them say which make some sense, but then there are things that I think makes no sense. So, you know, we'll see. I don't promise, but we'll see. Which sort of takes us to property, and I just did do this chart. I'll just put this up. This is actually the ABS Residential Property Price Index to September, right, which is the latest data that they have. And the bars for Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, Hobart, Darwin and Canberra are there. And, of course, what it shows is that the third quarter, which was to the June quarter, sort of the lower bars were negative. But in the last year, there's an average of 5.4% gain in Sydney, 4.7% in Melbourne, 3% in Brisbane, 2.6% in Adelaide, 2.4% in Perth, 5.9% in Hobart, minus 0.7% in Darwin, 5% in Canberra, and 4.5% in Australia average, right? So that's the data from the ABS. Now, of course, the ABS data is partly driven by the CoreLogic data. They do actually stratify it differently than CoreLogic does. And of course, these are averages, right? And the thing that I come back to when I look at those numbers, because people say, oh, well, you know, the M4 probably is doing really well, right? Well, compares with some of the other charts I showed, not so well, maybe. But, you know, Sydney at 5.4% over the last 12 months to September, and probably the next quarter to December will be also positive, suggests that there is still some net growth in property. But this is the key point. If you start then going down the level, what you understand quite soon is that the momentum is different in different parts of the property market, right? So houses in some areas are quite strong, units are very weak. I was looking at some places today in the urban fringe around Sydney and Melbourne where units are down 30%. Yeah. Over the last year, right? So in a way, these average indices tell you very little about what's really going on. It's a bit like showing the stock price for the total market and then, you know, the difference between financial stocks and tech stocks, right? There's differences. So you have to go granular to see what's going on. What do you think's happening in Melbourne, though, from your read of what's going on down there? Because I think things are a little bit stronger than they were, but they're still pretty weak.
Yeah, I do think, like you said, units are definitely underperforming. But what I have seen, and also I'm now in regional Victoria, is there's been a big demand for good big houses, you know, 3-4 bedrooms on decent sized blocks. There's been high demand. And what I'd assume if a lot of bigger houses on bigger blocks are selling and there's a lot of competition because supply is so low, and then they've had the interest rates drop so people can borrow more now. Mm. And then a lot of those types of properties start getting sold, then that would lift the averages. Where, like you said, I think Carlton, it's a suburb in the inner city of Melbourne, their unit prices have dropped around 30% from their peak. So it's a different story. And also the premium suburbs, so maybe the Bayside suburbs, you know, where people obviously going for the lifestyle now since the lockdowns. They don't want to be cooped up, you know, in a one bedroom studio apartment. They want to be, you know, close to the beach so then they can go out for a walk. Or and also at the start of the downturn, the data said that the upper end of the market was the first to move, and what's normally the first to move, where that's now recovering, normally the first to recover, the premium end of the market. And obviously regional, I've moved to Ballarat in regional Victoria. I think I was watching a few of the episodes of Mortgage Stress. It's pretty high here, but luckily, the prices have held up pretty good. I brought land here about 2.5 years ago before all the big regional rush, so I was lucky there. Like you said, you do have to go very granular. Even if you go to the suburb, there's good parts of the suburb. There may be a part in that suburb where it's a catchment to the top school, and that and prices in that, you know, catchment might be 20% higher or even more, or if it's close to public transport, good shops, good cafes, if there's a lake in that suburb. These are all things you have to factor in. You can't just say, okay, you know, the western part of Melbourne or Sydney or wherever, that's gone up 3%. You have to find the suburb, you have to find the type of property, even if they're a house on a small block versus a house on a big block. So I do think, just to cut the long story short, that the more unique properties, the properties on decent sized blocks, the ones that have a bit of scarcity, they're performing really good. There's a high demand for them. There's not much supply. With units where, you know, they're just a stock standard townhouse, there's really no FOMO there.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, you're reflecting quite well what's happening in and around Sydney as well. So there are areas where houses are actually in significant demand and prices are higher, but there are lots of units that are not. And in fact, as Cookie Boy and a few others have called out, you know, rents are in free fall, great times to negotiate. Elise, absolutely right. Again, I did a post quite recently about some of the latest data showing significant falls. What I'm discovering is that a number of people who actually thought that they had their rents frozen suddenly discovered that they didn't actually not owe the back rent. So they started to think about finding somewhere else a bit cheaper, right? Mm. So that's another factor in there. We also know that a lot of the new estates on the suburban fringes of our major centres is where a lot of the issues are, and that's where the mortgage stress is quite high. So Point Cook, for example, Narrewarren around there in Victoria, and Campbelltown in Sydney. In other places, stories are quite different, and in fact, I'll be updating my mortgage stress data for the first show of next year, and I'll be trying to look at some of the regional centres, because I think it's important to look at places like Adelaide and other regional areas as well. So I'm trying to sort of broaden it from a Sydney-Melbourne debate, but that's, of course, difficult because a lot of the property is actually in those two centres, right? 60% is in just those two centres. The other point, and in fact, Cookie, you must be reading my mind, oversupply, right? There is massive overbuild going on, right? There's already too much property, and now there's more property being built, more approvals being run at the moment. And so with the lack of migration, international migration zero, negative, in fact, the budget was suggesting it will be negative for the next 2 years, we've got an oversupply of property, particularly high-rise properties in a number of areas. And that, by the way, also includes places like the Gold Coast as well. Funnily enough, Dylan says, I know a guy on the Gold Coast planning to dump multiple properties next month. Mate's doing the same. Exactly. There is, in my surveys, I'm seeing precisely the same. I'm seeing a lot of people saying, after Christmas, you know, when it's all settled down a bit, we're going to try and put property on the market. So I expect to see the listings rise quite quickly, and I think we're going to see some very interesting changes in the momentum. I also would make the point there's a lot of vacant property in Melbourne, particularly Docklands, for example. Been doing some more research on that. We're seeing the same in some other high-rise areas in around Sydney. So even when people have actually bought the property, not necessarily living in it. So that's another factor which isn't really caught in the numbers, in my view. The vacancy rates are much higher because they're not trying to lease them, they're just not occupied. So I think we've got a lot of significant issues. Regional centres, definitely more popular at the moment. Some of the analysis I've done recently shows that there's been significant price rises, particularly for houses in some regional centres. And even rental supply is quite strong. There isn't much spare supply in some of those centres too. So there's a big rotation going on between the centre of town and close centre of town and further out, and exactly what you were saying. So it's pretty interesting times. I'll be running my scenarios next week, so I'll update those. I'm still expecting to see some price increases, but also some price drops. But again, granular. You have to go granular to understand what's going on. You can't just take these high-level property indices and say, see, that's what's going on, because it means nothing.
That's right. And something I saw, like you're talking about with all these new developments and new estates being built, where I was before I moved to Ballarat, it was in the west side of Melbourne. I think it was around 2018. This was towards the, because 2017, the market peaked, but the Western, the lower end of the market didn't actually peak in Melbourne until about 2018, where I was living. There was, like we're now, where there's low, very low supply. It was hard for me because I was looking at the time for a four-bedroom house. I couldn't find a four-bedroom house for, you know, under 420. This was in 2018. But now all these new estates have finished being built and there's so much supply. Also, when I couldn't find a property for 420, there were a lot of old properties. There was barely any new properties. But now because of all these estates have finished being built, there's a lot more supply now, a lot more choice. And I've seen properties listed for $370, $360 for a small three bedder. So that hasn't actually shown percentages, but just because there's more supply now, there's more choice. You could potentially get a property, you know, for 20% below what it was at the peak when there was no supply. And like you were talking, I think there was like barely any auctions during the peak of lockdown in Melbourne. Maybe there's like 50 to 100, where every week there's been a rise in listings and auctions every week in Melbourne. So if all these schemes keep being go towards first home buyers to build, that's just going to keep adding supply. And then if existing properties, if first home buyers don't want to buy them because they're getting, you know, $50,000 to $60,000 to in incentives to buy these new properties, they'll just keep adding supply. And if there's no immigration then to fill that, then we could, you know, in a year or two see an oversupply. So that's something I think in a more longer term, maybe a year to 2 years, is a risk for the housing market.
Yeah, and that's interesting. You've made a very important point, right? Over what time frame you're talking, right? So that there are people sort of spruiking the market, saying it's rising. Sure, well, it is rising a bit from where it was, but, you know, take a longer term view and then look forward ahead, which is including higher unemployment, lack of migration, the default rates probably rising because people are going to be out of mortgage interest principal repayment holidays. You know, there's other factors to bear in mind, which is trying to get a balance, right, between the bullish and the bearish perspective. That's really, well, my scenario is try and do that, but it's quite complicated to do that. And you have to go granular to really understand again, because different locations have different dynamics, right? There's different numbers of people buying and selling and all those things, different types of property, different price points, all of those things there. It's interesting how I've been watching Hobart and Adelaide as areas where, you know, there's still quite a lot of momentum relative to other places, but even there are some cracks showing in some types of property in some areas. Perth is quite strong now, you know, up in some cases significantly from where it was last year. But remember that Perth has dropped, what, 30% from its peak over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So, you know, they've got a long way to go to come back. At one stage, I remember Perth trumpeting that prices were more expensive than Sydney in Perth. I remember that a few years ago.
During the mining boom. I guess a lot of people would have moved there to make the correct big bucks.
Yeah, but it's not the case now. It's very different now. So there's a long way back from them. And I'm doing a bit more work on Mandurah, you know, one of my sort of leading edge, you know, example postcodes. And there's some quite interesting stuff going on there, because there are some prices moving up for some types of property in Mandurah, but not all properties. And there's a lot still going down. So fascinating dynamic there. So I'll probably make a show on Mandurah, and then of course the next few months, because I think it'll be interesting to sort of keep revisiting that. I don't pick on it particularly, other than it's a really good case study of the, if you like, you know, the worst of what can happen. So now I think we should just, before we finish, because we're running close to the end of our show, we should just touch on gold briefly. So let me just do this and put there. Yeah. So that's the gold price. This is the gold futures. It's up 18% over the year, right? Which is pretty good. Interesting, had a bit of a bumpy ride late November, and then it's gone sideways. And there's a bit of a debate about, you know, what is the future of gold. So you can have the Harry Dent of this world who says, gold will come bound a long way. Or you can have Peter Schiff who says, no, gold is going the other way. It's going to go. And it fundamentally comes back, I think, to whether gold is going to be the ultimate reserve currency, or whether the US dollar will remain the reserve currency, or whether something else will come in and replace it as an alternative reserve currency. And that's really, I think, the key difference between, frankly, the different perspectives that we have with regard to what's going on with gold, right? And, you know, I think Harry would say it's going to drop but then come back later. Peter Schiff says, no, it's going to go a lot higher because it's going to become the you know, frankly, the default, because nothing else has value, and he measures everything in terms of gold, so therefore that's why he has that view. I don't know. Again, I sit on the fence here. I say, look, there are lots of different perspectives. It's hard for me to read which way this is going to go. I do tend to think more deflation rather than inflation, which suggests to me that gold probably won't be as strong as some people were thinking it would be. But, you know, have you had a chance to sort of think about metals and gold, or is that something beyond, you know, your sort of portfolio in terms of investments?
Like I said, I look at everything. And if you look at gold over the past 20 years, it actually, just on the price, but you have to then factor in with the ASX 200, they pay a dividend, has actually outperformed the ASX 200. So it does have a part of your portfolio. And if, you know, you, in March, if you could have got it on discount, it would have been a great buy to buy gold. But something people have to always be aware with the gold markets and with people like Peter Schiff, or with a lot of these economic collapse channels, a lot of them are affiliated with gold. So they may get a commission or have an affiliate link for you to buy gold. So they're financially incentivized.
Funny that.
Yeah. So, you know, if I made a gold company and I was selling gold, why wouldn't I tell you to buy gold? And it's the same thing with property spruikers. You know, if a real estate agent's, you know, they're always going to tell you it's a great time to buy, you know, you got to buy now, or you should have bought yesterday. So that's just another thing you have to take in mind, just with anything, with any investment. When the person's telling you to invest, you have to think, do they have any financial gain from me getting involved in this investment? But I do think, again, I'll have a bit of, you know, my portfolio in precious metals, because they do have a store of value. They are, you know, old money, I guess you could say. There is always that risk, you know, or like that chance that, you know, if central banks do create a new currency and people say, no, we've seen what you've done to fiat currency, we know it's worthless, they could, you know, there's always a Hail Mary chance that they could say, okay, we'll back it by gold. And, you know, some people may happen. I don't know where it's going to happen. I think it probably won't, because it's too hard to then manipulate. Or so I think people want to have, you know, maybe not, again, not financial advice, but what I would do is probably have about 10% of my portfolio to 20% in gold. And I think what's happened recently with the bond market, some people, instead of holding bonds, have gone into gold. Not everyone, simply because there's no more yield on gold and no more yield on bonds. And maybe that's why they've gone into things like Bitcoin as well, just to store value, to diversify from stocks. So whether it's good now, it has had a bit of a pullback. I don't know if it's a good time to get in now, but, you know, in March it was definitely a good time. But like I said, I'd keep a watch on everything, stocks, real estate, cryptocurrencies, gold. If there is a big drop in either one of them, then you just diversify and keep on investing for the long term.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, investing long term, I think those are two really important points, right? You know, there's a difference between trading and investing. You know, investing means you actually are taking positions, you know, for long-term results, right? I mean, there are people trading, and of course, you know, they might well be fine sometimes, although actually if you look at it over the long term, many traders end up roughly even. So they win as many as they lose, right? So that's always the problem with trading, but long-term investing. And then I think the other thing that I come back to is spread the risks. I think we both agree on that. You know, you can't put all your eggs in one basket, and quantify the relative risks of different types of asset classes, right? Because not all asset classes are necessarily as risky. As somebody said earlier on in the stream there, you know, gold is as manipulated as many other prices. You know, it's not clean, right? A lot of investment banks are taking big positions on gold. Same with Bitcoin, same with this, same with that. So pretty much all prices have risks attached to them.
Everything's manipulated now.
well, but is it, I mean, that's a really important point. It is, right? And because of that, there isn't such thing as a risk-free investment, right? Okay, you can put the money in the bank and, you know, get 0.1% interest on it, right? But even then, there are a few risks attached to that. And that's why more people are sort of saying, no, we actually need to have market exposure, because, you know, the returns are too low. And in fact, the more I watch this, the more it seems to me that people being forced to take more market exposure, and that's what central banks want. You know, they want people to leverage the money out from people's savings accounts and putting it back into the economy, right? The trouble is, if it's going back into the markets to be able to sort of blow the markets up higher, it's not necessarily creating the right sort of momentum, and that's the problem I've got, because a lot of it is, I think. So that's just my sort of perspective in terms of how I see things bubbling on. But no, it is very interesting. But you say, you know, spread the risks. I think also you've got to have a certain willingness to monitor what's going on and change your strategy as things change, right? Because things do change, and they are going to change quite remarkably. I think that the next year, the next 12 months, will be as complex and difficult as the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're through the virus. I don't think that we're through the quantitative easing and the further rounds of liquidity injections. I still think the stock markets have room to go higher before they ultimately tip over. I think they will tip over, but timing is really difficult. My expectation is that property prices, particularly for houses, will continue to move higher in some areas, but not in all areas. On the other hand, there will be many units where prices will continue to fall, and that we'll see a bifurcation of the market between regional areas and more central areas. I think that migration will stay low for a long period of time. I wouldn't be surprised to see borders still shut at the end of next year. Maybe it'll be sooner, but it's not necessarily certain that it will be. Because I think this is going to take a long, slow grind. And so, again, a certain degree of conservatism required. But also, going back to what I said earlier on, sometimes it's worth taking a slightly contrarian position and saying, well, you know, maybe this will happen, maybe it won't happen, etc., etc. So complex, keep a track. And I think that the final thing to say is that your point, which you made very forcibly, and I absolutely agree with you, many people who are on the YouTube and on other channels too have an agenda, right? Because they work for a gold company, or they work for a Bitcoin company, or they work for this, or they work for a property company, right? So it's very important to understand the agendas that people have and why they're saying what they're saying. I'm a philosopher, so what I'm interested in is what I call the frame of reference within which people operate. Why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they saying what they're doing? And I think that's probably one of the most critical questions that I want to leave people with at the end of 2020, which is to say, you know, just reflect on that. What is it that's driving people to say what they're saying? What's behind it, right? Don't just take it at face value. And if we can help people understand more about why things are the way they are and what's driving them, then it seems to me that we end up with hopefully better outcomes for people. So in a way, I think you and I probably share a similar aspiration to help people become more informed to make better decisions.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I've strived for with making my channel. And like you said, I do think short term prices will probably keep going up for house prices because of low interest rates. If they do keep giving more stimulus, like in the US, more stimulus checks, the stock market in the short term will probably keep going up. There probably will be a crash like in every stock market at some point. So I do think, you know, that there's been a lot of cover-ups in 2020. They've, you know, just put Band-Aids over all the issues. So I do think 2021 will be the year to watch to see maybe what are the battle scars left over from 2020, or to see what economic, you know, aftermath, or once the dust all settles, what's going to show. Because, yeah, we've just seen kind of the good stuff, that all the free money, you know, you get a stimulus check, you get a stimulus check, you know, the government's gone Oprah Winfrey on everyone, giving everyone everything. So, yeah, 2021, now that they're starting to, you know, withdraw a little bit of the programs, will be the year to watch the case, say, okay, what's the real story now?
Yeah, exactly right. And question, you know, keep questioning, right? Ask what's behind what people say. So for me, that's, you know, be a bit skeptical, ask that extra question, right? Yeah. Now, I'm a philosopher, so I always want to say people ask the next question, but I think it's important, particularly now. So, exactly. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. I will just mention once again your own channel, right, which is over there. I will put a link in the comments below as well. So there's quite some really quite nice shows you've done already, and I'm sure you're going to be doing a few more ahead. So, you know, feel free to go check out Michael's channel. I'm sure that we'll keep tracking the economy over the next little while, and maybe we should touch base again a little bit down the track. But I wish you the very best for 2021, and also the best to all our followers and viewers and listeners. I hope that next year will not be as chaotic as this year, despite the fact that I have a nasty suspicion it may be. And I wish everybody a safe and happy New Year celebration. Michael, any last thoughts from you?
And thanks for having me on the channel, Martin. It's been fun. I always have a lot of fun chatting with you. And like you said, I do think we have a lot of same thoughts on certain topics. And yeah, I do wish everyone a happy new year for Friday. Obviously, you won't be on the channel on Friday. So yeah, no more thoughts for me. I think there will be many more shows in the future as we kind of watch all things unfold in 2021.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time. And what I'm just going to do now is I'll take you offline. I'll just tidy up the show, and then we'll go from there. So thank you for that. Let me just take that and that. There you go. So there you go. Michael, thanks very much for your time tonight. Really, really good to chat with you. And very appreciative from the audience there. A number of people saying thanks. That's great. George says it'll be a train wreck. 2022 will be even worse. Yep, well, it could well be. Just to say that next week I will be on again. I'll be running my latest stress scenarios. I'll have the postcode engine online, and that will be data up to the end of December. And there will be some changes because of what I'm seeing with regard to the latest from the surveys. Clues, Northern Beaches not looking quite so flash as they were a couple of weeks ago. But and I also will just may, if I may say, that if people are interested in getting information on a particular postcode suburb, then I have the DFA one-to-one service, which is something which I can still do and I'm still doing. There is a fee for doing that, but if you want to have a detailed conversation about a particular postcode, get all the information, mortgage stress, house trends, all those things, then that's available still. It's not financial advice, but it is sharing my data, so that's still available. Just contact me via the DFA blog if you would be interested in having an opportunity to discuss a particular suburb within a postcode. So I'd like to wish everyone a safe and happy new year. Thank you very much to everybody who's been on the stream tonight. Thanks for those who made a contribution via the chat, Ron. I think I didn't acknowledge yours. My apologies. Thank you very much for that. And thanks to Nick as well for his contributions. Keep safe. I hope everybody has a nice, happy new year. And come back next week for another slice of DFA mortgage stress, property scenarios, and postcode modeling. I look forward to seeing you then. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.